This is Studio Potter, the podcast. In this episode, Studio Potter partners with Garth Johnson and the Everson Museum of Art to share a conversation between Garth and Sana Musasama. The annual Ceramic Arts Lecture is a co-presentation of Syracuse University College of Visual and Performing Arts, the Everson Museum of Art, and the Chronicles of American Ceramics Foundation. This lecture series has been transcribed and prepared for publication by Studio Potter. The conversation between Garth and Sana was first recorded in conjunction with Sana's solo exhibition at the Everson titled Returning to Ourselves, which was exhibited from February 3rd through April 28th, 2024.
Give a warm orange welcome to Sana Musasama. Oh, and by the way, if you don't know me, I'm Garth Johnson. I am the Paul Phillips and Sharon Sullivan Curator of Ceramics at the Everson Museum of Art, where you can visit Sana's awesome exhibition, Returning to Ourselves, in the Robineau Gallery. So come tonight a little bit early for the lecture. You can experience the exhibition and really have the full Sana experience, which is great. So, Sana, I wanted to kick it off. I mentioned Queens already and how interesting it was for me to visit your home and your studio in Queens. And I was so delighted to find out that, you know, you live in the family home that you were raised in St. Albans, Queens. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, growing up in Queens at the time that you did? And there are some formative experiences that you had with identity, with dolls that are totally reflected in your show. So tell us a little bit about your upbringing in Queens.
Well, my father made a career out of the military, and the Navy base wasn't very, very far away. And so it was on a GI plan, it was a way that brown people could buy houses. And so that immediate area was an area where they would actually kind of Jim Crowed into. And so black families all gathered, got their homes and raised their children, and we became like a interconnectionist of family. I ran through everybody's house on the block, and I had many moms and dads. And if I happened to be at Mrs. Wilson's house when it was dinner time, she threw me in the tub with her kids and called my mom and said, I'm here, and I had dinner there. Or I was across the street with Mrs. Kimbrough and I did something wrong, she would discipline me and then call my mom. So it was a really interconnectedness of family, unity, love, and protection. Really, really very insulated, maybe about 8 or 9 blocks.
And now St. Albans and the area around you in Queens is heavily, heavily populated by people from Jamaica, from the West Indies, who in Southeast Asia. At the time that, you know, your father was able to purchase the house that you're in, was that the case? Was it already
not
multi?
At all. When my father purchased a home, which was probably in the 40s, it was Jewish community.
Okay.
A Jewish community, and then the base moved there, and then people came from all around the world, but black people were pushed there. And so slowly, slowly, slowly over time, unfortunately, the other people moved out and it became only a black hub. So it was just one of those things where people didn't want to live around difference. And so they moved slowly and slowly, slowly they moved out. I don't think there was ever any arguing. It was a silent kind of, we can't cohabitate together. Yeah. So then it became military, predominantly black American. And what these families did, which were about 13 families, is that they promised, because it was so hard to get there and live, that they would only cell within the family. So it's been four generations. But then what happened is people began to die. Some of us never came home from college, and we started moving out. And then that's when other groups, and then Queens started to gentrify, other groups of people, the basic moved, other nationalities became moved in. So now, I would say up until maybe 8-10 years ago, I could walk home and I could look in the face of a kid and see my girlfriend's grandchildren.
Oh, man.
You know, but now I don't know everybody on the block anymore, so my community's changed. Maybe there are four families that I know historically, and the rest are all semi-strangers. But I get up in the morning, I say good morning, I shovel for people, I get mail for people, and everyone who moves in on the block, I go and welcome them into the block and tell them a little bit about the history. But there is a radical difference now. People who have come in are coming in from parts of the world where it's warm and hot, and their landscape is very different. And so when they come to the new land, because that's what they consider it, they want their house to be the spotlight. So they chopped down. My block had 43 trees. Nana has two.
Oh.
They chopped down all the trees because the trees block the view of the one treasure that their whole lives were working toward. So I saw it happening right before me, and so I'd run out and say, don't chop down the trees. We need the trees. And they were trees. I said, you just go right back over to your house and mind your business. And then I would go, who they would hire, another group that is marginalized is the Mexican community. They'd hire the Mexicans to chop down the trees. And so I'd go to the Mexican guys and say, don't chop down the trees. And they would say, look, this is the only work your country gives me. I'm chopping down this tree. So they chopped down the trees, and so I then couldn't, I had no control over it. And so they chop them down in cookies, they call it, little gifts.
Oh, right.
And so I said, okay, move those cookies back to my house. So I protested by putting all the trees that were cut down, making the front yard with these giant cookies to make my house really ugly so that they could not take pictures with my house next to it. But then I got termites.
Oh, no.
So I had to get rid of the cookies. So it's just the difference. It's radically different. A lot of my neighbors who've come in from Southeast Asia have not really invested in what the zoning laws are. It's a community. You can't have a business. They've opened little businesses. You cannot use firecrackers in the summer. Their children do it. They use their fingers, their fires. So it's just radical rattle. I don't feel at home anymore there as much.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned Jim Crow and, you know, your father buying the house and the reason for the African-American enclave in St. Albans. But your formative years and growing up kind of straddle the civil rights era, mm-hmm. and part of the exhibition that's up at the Everson, I think, has amazing connections to that for me. And can you talk a little bit about, I don't know, societal pressures as growing up as a girl, you know, in that era? You have talked to me about the dolls that you had and, you know, the societal pressures that you were under, but that you were also around people who had a strong sense of identity and Black identity. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, particularly unpacking the story, you know, around your mother and your relationship with dolls as a little girl?
I have four sisters. And growing up, and we lived in an extended family, so the house was crowded with people all the time. So with just us, it would have been seven. There was always an uncle or aunt who came and never kind of left. And so in growing up, my parents came from the South Carolina in a very turbulent, violent time in history. And as young girls, my parents did not tell us the stories of their childhood. It was too brutal. They didn't want us to know about it. But on their deathbeds, we heard horrible, horrible, horrible stories all the way up until my last aunt, who died in 2018, as she was rambling and talking. she was violated. She was beat up. And so my parents protected us from that. When the world was turbulent in the 60s and the 70s, my parents were frightened. They were scared for their 5 daughters to go out and protest. They told us to be invisible. They thought if we were quiet, nobody would harm us, but it wasn't true. But we were our parents' children, but we were also children of the world. And we went to school, and we went to school with other kids. And my parents, because my father was in the military and they moved around for 15 years before they settled into, when they did decide to have family, they were much older parents. They were 15 years older than the regular parents who had had a different history. So my girlfriend's parents and brothers were protesting and going out in the streets, and my parents were in the house quiet because of their residual history. But me and my sisters went beyond my parents. We would just say, "We have to go, Mommy. We have to march." And they trembled as we walked out the door and said, "We're protesting. We're going to go do this. You know, that Black Pride. We're not going to perm our hair anymore." They were frozen. But the world becomes, your outside world is your world too. And it changed and shaped each and every one of us. And we all had friends with different kinds of parents. And so we listened to their stories, and I listened to their stories, and I just said that we have to be active, we have to do something. But still, even in my activism, it was far less than Paula, who was my age, but whose mother was 20 years younger, radically different. Her mother was out there with her. My mother was at the door looking out and praying that nothing would happen to us.
So even though your parents weren't on the front line of the struggle, you were getting positive feedback about your history and your identity. And I'll nudge you toward the doll story.
It's a beautiful story. I guess when I was reaching probably my teens, late teens, maybe middle teens, when all of a sudden I identified the opposite sex and on the block, and because the block, many military men, when they came home from service, they would come home with the wives from the countries that they were in, and they weren't Black women. They were of other nationalities. And so, for us as kids, we didn't see any difference. But when we got to teenage age and our other worlds integrated, it became obvious that boys on the block who had gone to other schools or other experiences who came back on the block at that point had another worldly view. And so what was happening is I would have a crush on a guy, but he would be more interested in the Black girl who was biracial. And that's what happened. So there began a divide right there that I began to see. All of my sisters and I are brown. My mother is brown. My dad is brown, chocolate brown. But these girls were all honey color. Their hair was wavy. The guy said, "Their hair blows in the wind. My hair can't blow in the wind." And so all of a sudden I saw a difference. And the difference was a little heartbreaking that made me not like me, made me not like my full nose and my full lips and my high forehead and my kinky hair. And my mother saw me sulk one day about it, because I'd come home and sit at the table and just be quiet. And so I said, it's no big deal. And she peeked at my story, and I told her what was going on. She sat there very, very quiet. And then she said, "Go get your comb. Go get your brush. Let's get some tools. Let's make something together." And I didn't know what she wanted to do, but because it was a crowded household with 5 girls, aunts and uncles, I was so happy to just sit next to Mom one-on-one for a little while. And what she did is she got all these materials at the kitchen table and where I sit right now and on the computer. And she began to shape a doll. And she took my hair out of my brush and comb, and she took pipe cleaners and she wrapped around it. And she had so much joy making that doll. And I just was just looking at Mom being so happy and looking at Mom with Sana one-on-one. And she said, "Isn't it beautiful?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Let's put some beads. Go get your nail polish. Let's put some lipstick on her. Let's do this. Let's do that." And then she looked down at me and she says, "You have pretty skin, my second daughter." She always called me her second daughter. And I said, And then when that doll was finished and she looked at it, she says, "What do you think?" I said, "Mom, it's beautiful. It's beautiful." And she said, "And so are you. And don't you forget it." And she says, "Never compare what somebody else has. Only glorify what you have and appreciate what they have." And it was the first time, I was probably 14 or 15, that I looked at my mother and saw her and her family of seven children as the only brown child. All of her siblings were light-skinned. Everyone. And then I thought to myself, what did she go through growing up in South Carolina with a dark brown father, her being dark brown, a light-skinned mother with wavy hair, light eyes, and all of her siblings being light? I realized, what did mommy go through? And it's the first time I saw a difference in color within my family.
This is the first time I think that the host has ever needed a box of tissues up at the on the stage here. I want to keep talking a little bit about New York City, which is where you've made your whole career. You went to Alfred for graduate school and left New York then. But we have these ideas of New York as, being Manhattan, the center of the art world. But of course, the art world is much more multi-layered than that. And you are such a creature of nipping into Manhattan to teach for shows. Mm-hmm. And I gather that that's kind of been the case throughout your whole career. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about a working artist's experience of kind of the five boroughs and participating in culture over the decades in a wider New York than we usually think of?
What went on in my life is in the 60s, there was this plan called open enrollment. And what it did is it bussed black children into white schools for better education. And so all of a sudden we began to be very penetrated. And so I was bused far away. The school bus came, because I live so far, the bus picked me up in front of my house and began to take us in the community, different places. And I just remember entering, I think it was fourth grade, and being the only black kid in the entire school. It was PS 90 in Richmond Hill. And my sister, another school. And so in this busing out to go to school and your parents going to meetings, St. Albans, Queens opened up and my world became all these other worlds. Also to visit relatives that lived in Harlem. Every Sunday was a family day. We'd sit at the dining room table, tell stories, and then we would go to Manhattan. We went to hubs, other places, and so we went to the Bronx where relatives lived. Everybody from the South migrated. So we went to the Bronx, we went to Queens, we went to Staten Island, we went to Brooklyn. And so for me, I live in all those places, to be honest with you. As a professor, I get up in the morning and I go to Hunter College, or did, I'm retired. And then I'd go to John Jay, which is the opposite side. And then I'd have to shoot to the Bronx for a night class and then go to Staten Island for another class. So for me, as a world traveler, it's nothing to bounce around the boroughs if I can get on a plane and fly everywhere in the world. So for me, it's just very, very natural. I was laughing with a friend the other day that when I come out my house, I make a left to go to the bus stop to get to the train. I don't even know what's on the right anymore. I don't go in that direction. So my world just expanded beyond that. So all of its home. It makes me think of when I'm in traveling in Southeast Asia, you can go to Sapa, and it's the Golden Triangle. You can have one foot in Vietnam, another foot in Cambodia, and another foot. That's how I feel about it. My feet are in all these places as I move around. I weave through them easily. In New York City with public transportation, it is easy to be in all of these places in the course of one day. Very, very easily. Bouncing back and forth all day long.
And you're in very, very good company. I mean, there are so many working artists who are juggling so many things.
Juggling, that's right.
It's been beautiful in setting up your exhibition. So many artists across different disciplines in New York all know you. It has really struck me how wide the network of artists is, and social friendships that mm-hmm. have sort of grown over the years. Can you talk a little bit about that? You started by talking about the web of relationships on your blog, mm-hmm. but can you widen that out to talk about the relationship with artists who are kind of in the same lifestyle and situation as you?
Sure. I think that, I think maybe a little bit of it might have started listening to my mother, the way she grew up, which was very, 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 very poor. My grandfather died. And I can remember hearing them talk around the dining room table that my grandmother put her children in four different schools that staggered time because they all wore the same outfit. So she had to wait for Aunt Dot to come home, for Sadie to put on her shoes and go, and for her and stagger like that. And so with that, I forgot my thought because that just popped up. So with that thought of that merging and sharing, I grew up sharing. I grew up seeing. So it's very natural for me to be curious about other and somebody else. And so I reach out. I go to everything that I can. I introduce myself to people. I want to know where they come from, what their languages are, what their dreams are, what their passions are. I want to know about their art and the current that makes them make it. So, and also I think that it's, as an artist, we make our work in our studios for our own heartbeat, but we really want the world to come and see it. So I go out to the world because I want the world to come back to me. I don't want to be invisible in my studio practice. So I used to be almost at everything. Now I'm too tired to get to most things, but I used to be at everything at the right time, all the time, thinking this is what you do and this is how it works. And artists want our work to live beyond us. Museums are the home. So museums were always my connection. So museums, like the Studio Museum in Harlem, as a residency program. So residency programs I apply to just to open my world, open my world, open my world. My dining room table was such fertile ground growing up with all these stories. I've been trying all my life to create my dining room table wherever I am. So whether I'm in Cambodia or India or Latin America, I'm trying to hold hands. I'm trying to hold hands. So one of the beautiful things about Nsika is going there and holding hands with a huge, huge community. And one of the things that was particularly beautiful and impactful about last year's Nsika is that when I got up on stage to with the Adira Willard with the Clay Holes Water exhibition, and I was the third one to speak, and I'm sure I was probably 45 years older than the young lady sitting next to me. But I was sitting there looking at them with their cell phones and their speech on their cell phone. And here I was looking at my piece of paper with my note on. I got shy. But then I looked out into the audience, and for the first time in 40 years, it was colorful. It was colorful. And I looked and I said, oh my goodness, look at this. There's everybody here. I'd never seen that before. I remember going to Nsika 40 years ago where there were 7 or 8 black women, and we were all the same person. People would walk up to me and say, are you Sid?
No.
Said, no, I'm not Sid, but Sid's over there. And then they said, are you Mapo? And I said, no, I'm Sana, but Mapo's over there. We held the weight of it. But I looked out in the audience, and I got overwhelmed with it and very, very emotional. And then Yinka held the black coffee shop, and I went there, and me, Sid, and Mapo were sitting there. We had our mask on, and our masks were wet to our faces. And we held each other's hands, and we said, Sana, look at all these brown people. She said, we don't know them. It was a joy that we don't know them. So here it is, just expanding and expanding and expanding.
Beautiful. Let's stick with related themes. And you talked a little bit about, in all of the things that you talked about in your upbringing, none of them screamed, you know, the arts. You didn't have parents who were artists.
Yeah.
I grew up rurally in a much different environment, but also with one where I didn't have immediate role models who were in the arts. Can you talk about about the flashpoint where you realized that, and this may be two different events, but where you really connected with visual art, and when did you realize that it could be a viable career for you?
I never thought about it as a career. To be honest with you, I just thought about it as a breath, something that I could do very easily, sit in the corner and love to do it. But as children, my mother took advantage of everything that was free. And so we went to Bible schools where art classes were taught, or the churches. She found out where creative things were, and she just marched us and put us in there every weekend. So I always grew up with tinkering with things. And then also being in a crowded household, you find things to entertain yourself with when you don't have mom and dad right there. So I was always in the backyard forming and changing things. Our neighbors, who were also our parents, each one of them had a little skill. So Aunt Mina, who wasn't blood Aunt Mina, taught Vicky piano lessons. Mrs. Kimbrough next door, who came from a fishing family, taught me macrame. So our neighbors were our, my mother brought people in that did these things. So we were always really shaping and changing things. Art, talking about art and art in the world, no, it wasn't a conversation, but it was an artful arena that put a kernel in me, too. When it was time to decide on education in schools, art never came up, not at all. But I had a teacher in the school around the corner in third grade, and she told my mother one open school night, she said, she's incredibly, incredibly creative. She sits in the room and draws like your daughter all the time. When the other kids are acting up, she just picks up a piece of paper and draws me. She said, we don't have art supplies. It won't go beyond a certain point. Send her to schools where she can develop. And my parents said, develop into what? And they said, just let her develop into her creative. She said, she's already creative. They said, but it'll expand. And she said, I insist, just think about it. And so they found a school that was very good in art, which was Richmond Hill. And my mother, that's where I got bused to in the fourth grade at the fear of my mother and father, tremendous fear, because here I was, 9 and a half, going on a bus, 45 minutes to an all-white neighborhood, and all they could think of was their childhood and what had happened to them. And so they were very, very fearful. So they went to the school. I remember the first day of school, the bus driver picked me up because I had to get on that bus, but my father followed the bus, and he stayed outside the entire day of school just to make sure that nobody would invade the school, because his residual memory was KKK and lynchings. And so he stayed outside that school and waited. And when I came outside the school, I said, Daddy, it's okay. He said, did you make friends? I said, no, nobody talked to me. In fact, on the first day of school, we lined up outside the door of the classroom, and the teacher brought us all in, and I looked around and everybody was my age, and we looked at each other and looked away because we were all 9 and 10 years old and very, very shy. And I had on my new dress and my new shoes, and I was really happy to be there, but also a little nervous and scared. But the school was so colorful with beautiful things. I just said, oh, I'm going to make that. And so the teacher said, okay, I want everybody to draw their family. And so she picked up this big shoe box. She put paper on the table for all of us, walked around, and she picked up the shoe box, and she walked around, and she started giving everybody, dumping bunches of crayons to them. And so here I was sitting at my seat waiting, because my mother had given me all these rules You're going to be quiet from her histories. You're going to sit there. You're not going to be scared. If anybody calls you a name, you're not going to hear it. So I was sitting there waiting, and I just remember sitting there, and I could see her shoes right there in front of me. And I looked down at her shoes, and I noticed that she wasn't moving. And the room got a little quiet, and so I just slowly looked up at her, and she looked down at me, and I could see in her face she hated me. She hated me. And so I just looked at her and leaned back, and she wasn't giving me any crayons. And so I put my hand in the box, and she slapped me. Not in the face, but slapped my hand and threw a black crayon down and said, "That's all you need."
Wow.
And then she went, and I sat there frozen, and the other kids in the class, some laughed, some were frightened, some went quiet. And I looked at that black crayon, and I began to sketch. And I just began to sketch. And I went home that day wounded and told my mother she only gave me a black crayon. She said, "She'll give you more tomorrow." All of fourth grade, Mrs. Bander only gave me black crayons. So my mother brought me my own box of crayons. And I went in with them, and she made clear, "You bring them home every single day with you." And so I began to sketch, and I also began to get introverted. I stopped talking. I stopped being friendly. I started, I think, probably having maybe emotional problems because I started wetting the bed, and I started being a discipline problem at home. I started talking back and being sassy and rude in ways, and nobody knew what it was about. And my father said, "She's blossoming, she's growing up." But something was happening in that classroom. I never, ever was invited to a birthday party. Never. In the schoolyard, I played by myself. No kids played with me. The cooks in the school, of course, were minorities. And they would see me in the courtyard playing with a rock, playing hopscotch by myself. And they'd see me down there by myself, and they knew what was going on. And so they'd come down and see to my teacher, who never made us play together. And they'd say, "We're going to take her to the kitchen." And they'd take me in the kitchen, and we'd bake cookies and cakes. And it made me feel at home. They also would give me tips. They would say, "Never go down the stairs by yourself. Never go down that corridor by yourself." They looked at, they became another mommy, and they were all Latino, and they cared for me, and they made me feel centered. And then I came home and started just complaining, "Why me?" Mommy said, "Well, you're the most creative one. It's the best school." I said, "But why me? Mm-hmm. Why?" And I cried, and she sat me on her lap one day, and she said, "You're a pioneer, and you're making it easy for all the other kids that'll come years later, because open enrollment was going to get bigger and bigger." And I looked at her and said, "I don't want to be a pioneer. I want to be 9 years old, Mommy." And she just hugged me. Oh. So.
But later on in high school, did you have some powerful mentors or teachers that emerged, or did you struggle throughout?
The school went through high school.
Okay.
It went all the way through. It went from early to 12. So very little, but because I had the back room at home and because I was still going to these pre-programs, I always did it outside of the classroom. And the teachers who recognized the talent that weren't as evil as that fourth grade teacher, they would say, "Draw this for my room, draw that for my room, do this for my room." And so I was always doing those kinds of things. So there was no ceramics, there was no sculpture. It was always pieces of paper and crayons. And so I was always doing it. But it wasn't until actually college that another world opened up, and that's when I saw ceramics.
Again, back up just slightly, and I was just putting this together in my head, that when you were young, a powerful thing happened where the world converged in Queens. So do you have memories? Did you get to go to the World's Fair?
Oh, absolutely.
So are there any standout memories of things from the World's Fair in Queens? And 1960, I don't want to tell tales on the age or anything, but 1963?
So 1963, 64, I think around that time. Yeah, but I'm 51, so I just remember being all dressed up and walking around and seeing the world, seeing other nationalities, seeing objects and art that came from other places, and just getting stronger and stronger and stronger about there's a world out there, Sana, but not really knowing how to put my hand on it. But yes, we went many, many, many times. Mm. And seeing things from all over the places was a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous joy. And then I had an aunt, Finney, who was also incredibly creative. And she was the first black child to enter art and design. And she made beautiful, beautiful, beautiful clothing. And she lived in Harlem. We went to her house on Sundays. And so she was also another strong reference. Aunt Finney was off the chart. I mean, you'd go to her house, and it was wonderful, gaudy. Things were sewn onto the walls, onto the curtains. The shower curtains had bells on them. You know what I mean? Everything, the couch had this stitched on it. It was just crazy. It was just completely crazy. But she was so creative in there. And that was a world that I sank into every Sunday. But Aunt Finney, you know how you maybe go to, Home Depot, and you go through the plant section, and you see all these little peacocks and mannequins that you can stick in your yard and flowers. Well, Aunt Finney sewed them onto drapes. Oh. So you had birds. There was no limitations. It was just everywhere. Her whole house was just a collage. Nothing got thrown out. Something that was a quilt all of a sudden became the corner or a pillow. So she popped my bubble.
Well, I visited your house, and you are no minimalist, Sana.
No,
but
I know.
Your house is a visual record of your lifetime of relationships with artists and traveling.
Yeah.
And so you are in a living artwork at home. So you had started to mention college and looking at college. What was that path like? And
I went to City College in Harlem, and I didn't know what I wanted. Well, my older sister Vicky, who was a pianist, went to Hofstra, and then from there she was trying to get into Juilliard, and my parents were saving up for a very, very expensive school, and I heard all the talking about where money was, extended family money came from everywhere. Aunt Finney made our Easter dresses every year, you know. So hearing those stories about Vicky getting into Harvard and that being so expensive, I knew not to dare ask. So I just applied to city schools, and when I got into City College, I went. And when they said, what do you want to major in or what are your interests, I had really nothing. I didn't think about art as a career. So I know that my dad, if the world could have been the way he wanted to have been, he would have been a lawyer, he would have been an anthropologist, he would have studied languages. If the world had been the way my mother would have been, she would have been a nurse or gone into medicine, but the world wasn't their world. So when they asked me what I wanted to be, I picked a little bit of daddy and a little piece of mommy, and said, I'll be them. But it wasn't Sana, really. And so I was here going through all the first 2 years, you know, go through like open foundation, for lack of a better word. I forgot what it is. Well, you just take a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. But anthropology was in my head because of Dad, and also being in the military, hearing all these stories. And so to get to the anthropology department, you had to walk through Eisner Hall, which is the art department. So I'd walk through the door, and then you'd have to make a short left. But right there, before you made that short left, was the ceramic room. So I stood outside this door, the ceramic room, and I just peek in. And I loved the smell of the clay, and I loved the room was really big and roomy, and objects were everywhere, and clay was on the floor, and it was filled with women. And this was in the 60s, late 60s. It was filled with women, and they were talking about the Vietnam War. They were talking about taking off their bras and throwing them off. They were talking about feminism. The black movement was being talked about. Decolonization in the world was going on. And that room was my dining room table. once again, and I stood there and I missed all my classes all the time, standing and listening to these women talk. They also talked about world travel, and I had never been out of the country, and I just stood there and listened and listened. And then one day the teacher came out, Paul Chaloff and Walter Yovaish, and they came out and they introduced themselves and they said, "Why don't you take a class?" And I said, I never did this before. They said, "So what? Just take a class." So I went to register for a class and it was filled. And so the next semester I just stood by that door and he came out and he said, "Why didn't you register?" I said, "I did, it was full." He said, "Go get that paper and bring it to me." So he went in, I went and got the paper and he signed it. And I went in. It was my final semester of school. I stood by that door 3 semesters. And so when I got into that room, he put clay in front of me. At the time, there was no such thing as a syllabus. No such thing. He's put the clay in front of me. And I looked at the clay. And he said, "Work." And I said, "Okay." So I looked to someone beside me and I looked to the other person beside me. And one girl was shaping this beautiful casserole, and another person there was hand building, was making something. And so what I did is I just looked at them and looked around the room, and I copied them. I just started rolling, peeling, and shaping things, and I just kept looking and making, putting things together, and feeling this tremendous joy with this material that responded so easily to my hand. It picked up my fingerprints. I oozed through it. It didn't need any prerequisite, and I just started shaping this form. And then after the form was shaped and I looked at it and I looked at the teacher and he just said like this, I then said, "Now what? Now what? Sana, this is a little bit of her and this is a little bit of him." Meanwhile, they had moved away from me because I was copying them. And then I said, I looked at this form and I said, "Well, that was a little bit of her and that was a little bit of him. Where's you, Sana?" And I picked up a needle tool and I began to etch. And I began to etch and carve stories that I don't know where they came from. But my heart was pounding, and I was sweating, and I knew I was home. And what I can say about all my earlier work is not so much the forms, but the language of what I created on it that I did not know how to speak, but I trusted it.
Wow. So I'm going to return to that, and it connects to everything that you see in your exhibition at the Everson, but I didn't know that you had studied with Paul Chaloff.
And yeah.
I'm gathering that a lot of the students who are in the audience haven't heard of him, but within the ceramics world, legendary, part of the Everson collection, mm-hmm. really thought of as a major artist. And hearing you talk about him seeing something in you and mm-hmm. connecting as mm-hmm. an opposite of the experience that you had in elementary school.
Totally.
Did you maintain a relationship with Chaloff
until
afterwards?
Until today.
Beautiful.
Until today. I know his daughter, his wife. I visited his studio. He lives upstate New York, and he has a huge, he's no longer, but he's on like 3 acres of land. He has a chair at the tip of the mountain. He said, "Sana, go sit there." So no, I'm in touch with Paul. When I see him in the city, we end up at the same parties. Yes.
So
I'm in touch with Paul.
Beautiful thing about the ceramics world, and I have sort of the exact same relationship with the person who put clay in my hands
yeah.
for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
so
there's a long gap between the time that you graduated from and got your undergraduate degree and when you decided to go to graduate
yeah.
school. Can you talk a little bit about finding your confidence in yourself and that long period, which, you know, if we're thinking historically as well, the 1970s were such a turbulent period with, you know, Vietnam and then going into the oil crisis and the crisis in the Middle East. There were so many kind of turbulent transitional things that are happening to us as a nation, as I feel like you are, you know, as a young adult trying mm-hmm. to find your way. Can you talk a little bit about
feminism and
that time?
And nationalism, all that was weaved into it. Well, those conversations went on in that ceramic room. I listened to people talk about it. And although in that ceramic room there were no people of color, the women or students that were there were activists. They came from different kinds of families. Their dads were the professors there. So they've had other worldly experiences. They talked about the Middle East. They talked about Vietnam. They invited me to go protest with them. they exposed the world to me, and I wanted to know about it. Every break, they traveled abroad. They came back. I would sit with them at lunch and hear these stories. Every time they went away, I had to get four or five jobs so I could be back with them in the fall. So I kept saying, one day, one day, one day, one day. And so when it came to graduating after that semester, they were all applying to grad schools to go study art. Well, I couldn't do that. I'd taken one ceramic class. It was impossible to think about art school. But I knew that that was what I wanted to do. So what I did one day is I left the ceramic room when they were all coming in with their acceptance letters and what they were going to do. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. All I knew was jobs. My whole college, which should have been 4 years, was 6 years. But because I took jobs, so I would work 9 to 3, and so all of my classes would have to be from 6 to this. Or I'd switch my working hours from 11 to 9 to 3. So I would sit in all these different classes, and not all of them I loved, but because that's where I got my economics from. But I'd hear pieces of stories about other worlds. And so what I did is I went to the library and I just said, where's ceramics? And I opened these books and they were picture books. And I went through them and I saw clays everywhere. And everybody, every race has made something with it, Sana. Look, clays everywhere. And then I said to myself, you can't go to graduate school. You don't have a body of work. You don't even know what a body of work is. But if clay's around the world and you want to see the world, why not travel the world and learn it? And so what I did is I sat down and made out a plan of the different places in the world that I would go to and learn ceramics. And I did it purely by what the ceramic pieces looked like. So if I opened a book and it was India and I saw something that echoed something that made me think I could do that, I bought a ticket, I went to India, I went to Africa, I went to Latin America, and I did it over and over and over again for 10 years. Then I came home, made a body of work, and applied to graduate school.
So what was your first international ceramic-led bit of travel?
Africa. So as a Black American, I chose Africa first.
Can you talk about that? Do you want to tell us the year and what it was like for you to, for the, you know, I've been to Africa, but mm-hmm. it was not my first time traveling internationally. Yeah. Can you talk about that being your first experience of international travel?
Yeah, sure. I can see myself at the airport now with my mother crying and my father throwing my luggage. They were very upset. I went to an agency. I knew I had a little plan. It was to go to Ghana because I loved what the pieces looked like there. And so I went and brought a one-way ticket for $250 because that's all I could afford. And in that classroom at City College, I always heard the other students talk about, well, if you get stuck in another country and you don't have any money, just go to the embassy and they'll send you home. So I said, okay, I'll just get a one-way ticket. And when I run out of money, I'll go to the embassy and send me home. It doesn't work that way. It does not work that way. I went to the embassy and said, send me home now. They said, what? They were going to take my bank account, my passport away from me for 7 years. They were going to get in touch with every job I ever had and get in touch with them. And I said, oh, no, 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 I can't have them do that. I got to figure out how to get home. So I wrote on Dot. I said, on Dot, send me $1,000 so I can come home. And she said, how? Because no banks or anything like that. And we had already learned in the Black community, because we were always sending money back and forth to each other, you wrap it in carbon paper and put it in an envelope. Nobody can see the money through it. So my dad put $1,000 in carbon paper and sent it to me. But I went to Ghana. And when I arrived in Ghana, I had a buddy friend who was already there because he was searching the world too. And I got into the airport in Ghana. And I had my passport, and I was getting online, and like many of us, some airports close when there's no planes coming in. So here I was online to go through immigration, and I'm excited. I got my backpack and everything, and I feel this hot air on my shoulder, and I turn around real quick, and I look up, and there's a gentleman standing there, and just by looking at his dress, I knew immediately he wasn't on that plane with me. And so it was a little too close for comfort. I went to another line to get away from him, and I got on that line, and then I felt a presence, and I turned around, and he was there again. And then I went to another line, and this time I'm watching him, and he's keeping a distance, And then all of a sudden, the immigration officers were getting ready to close up shop and close the airport for the day. And so I knew I'm going to get stuck in the airport with this guy. And then I turned around to him, and I was scared because I was scared of being there with him. And the immigration guys just figured, oh, just leave her here. And so I turned to him. His name is Lahai. And I said, you're following. My voice was cracking. I said, you're following me. Why are you following me? Please leave me alone. And he backed off from me a little bit because he saw me trembling. And then he reached into his pocket, and I really backed up then because I didn't know what he was going to do. And he pointed, and he had coins in his hands. And he said, if you feed me one meal a day, I will show you Africa. So what Lahai was is a guide who goes to the airports looking for Westerners to be a guide. And he was probably about my age. I didn't know. I was 23. And now I see it all the time when I go to the airport, little scouts outside saying, you want to see this? You want to see this with a little map? And so he said, and I looked into his eyes that day. And I looked at those coins, and I didn't know what they meant. They looked like quarters. So I said, well, that can't be expensive. And I knew I had a buddy outside the airport. They don't let people in the airport. And so I looked at Lahai, and his body frame was like mine, very thin and a little taller. And I looked at him, and I looked into his eyes, and my shoulders began to relax and telling me, he won't hurt you, Sana. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, he is the same size as me and the same weight. He gets out of line, I think I can kick his ass. So I said, okay, I have a friend outside the airport. We'll meet and connect. So we got outside the airport. I introduced the two of them together. We both agreed, and he lived in Sierra Leone, and Ghana's here, and Sierra Leone is way up there, and we just agreed that we would travel to his village where I would do art, Mende art, which is one on my calendar, and my only rule was that the travel had to be by land, no over. I wanted to penetrate through every village, through every nook and cranny that he took me through, and so it took us 3 months to get to his village. All during that time, I'm seeing dress, adornment practices, pottery, blacksmith, just macrame, weaving. I'm seeing all of this, and I have a journal, and I'm documenting and writing everything down. And then when I got plopped into Mende land, Sierra Leone, it was rainy season, had just beat away the topsoil, and it was believed that God was telling everybody to be a potter. So pottery season opened up, and then I began making. And it was really a beautiful thing because maybe there were about 5,000 people in this huge village. And the whole village turned into this huge, huge, huge circle. And you had people who were digging into the earth, taking the clay out of it. And then you had another, and maybe 80 people doing that. And then you had 50 people praying to the gods for putting it there. And then you had another people wedging it, and then another people putting grog into it. That clay moved around. Then you had somebody pinch the bottom, and then you had somebody put the belly, and then you had somebody put the handle, and somebody put the lip, and it just kept moving around. And I just remember when I got one of the pots in front of my hand, and I looked at it, and I looked at what everybody was doing, and I said, okay, I'm going to make the lip do this. And I started trimming the lip, and then somebody said, I said, why? She said, tradition, tradition, tradition. And she pointed to all the other pots. And then I realized, you have to make them in their language. So I put that lip right back up and followed the instructions of everyone. But what was really, really magical about it is that the conclusion of a pot being made, and they were always water jugs to contain water from God, for our burial jars, is that the women who wore loppers, which is just a cloth that you knot around your waist, when nobody was looking, they'd pick up a roller that they had made, and in the bottom of the piece, they'd put a little stamp, or under the underlip, they put a little carve, under this, under the handle, they'd little. And I looked at them doing this, and I looked at these beautiful clay rollers, and I was saying, that's her putting her signature on something without saying it's mine, because everybody has touched it. Not everybody could put their name on it, but they could put something tiny, and that mesmerized me. It also was a link to unspoken language. The woman who would carve that certain pattern on the bottom of that I would look at and examine, then I'd look at her and look at her batik outfit. That pattern is in her batik outfit. Then if I followed her home, that pattern is painted on her hut. If I went into her kitchen, that pattern was all over the wall. I started learning about these women friends of mine, not by their names, but by their patterns. So I began to make rollers, and I've never stopped making rollers. And I call them signature rollers because I don't sign my work. I put my roller pattern, and that's my signature. So that's where a whole way of working. And market day, people come with different pots, different shapes. This was all a visual language that I was learning right there.
Two of Sana and Garth's conversation will be published in our next episode. Thank you for listening to Studio Potter, the podcast.